Well, it's that time again, time for another wonderful concert with the Amadeus Ensemble. And we have with us today Maestro Valentin Radu and the wonderful guest that is going to be performing some several piano concertos on their concert, the Three B's. It's going to be on Friday, May 15th at 8 p.m. at the Kimmel Center. Peter Donahoe is once again visiting us from the UK, and they're here today, and we're all speaking together.
Hello.
Hello.
From the other side of the Atlantic.
Yes. You can't stay away from Philadelphia, huh?
No, indeed. Well, I'm very flattered to be invited so frequently to such a great place and to make music with these fantastic people.
Well, it's wonderful to have you as a soloist, and you have a really very exciting program, Valentin.
Well, I have to say that to interject that he is very beloved here, very beloved, and both by the public who is starting to really appreciate his art, but also mostly by my orchestra that just absolutely adores him, and they can't wait to play together, and they appreciate not only his amazing high level of artistry, technique and whatnot, but also his human qualities and his modesty and his wit and his fun and his interjections and his observations and his smiles and so forth. So
Oh, thank you. It is a wonderful... No, seriously.
And you know that. I'm just reiterating for the
public. Well, I'm just getting embarrassed on the other
side. I was going to say you have to live up to all of that, Peter. The one thing I do know is I did not meet you the last time in person. Of course, we spoke on the phone, but you are an outstanding artist, and you have quite a program that you're doing. Did you choose it? Do you have favorites or what?
Well, I suppose the answer to that, as with all these things, it's a half choice. I chose the idea, or suggested the idea, not really expecting that it would be taken up by the maestro. But he did.
Well, we did talk about this idea of the three B's. I think you mentioned that you've done it somewhere else. I'm not sure if they were the same.
I did a kind of variant upon it. It was actually in Seoul, South Korea.
Yes, yes.
Where they invited me to put together a program all in the same key. Uh-huh. Which actually is not what we're doing in Philadelphia.
No, this is the same letter.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was very strange because I thought of the Bach D minor concerto, the Mozart D minor concerto, and the Brahms D minor. And then when I turned up, they invited me to do Rachmaninoff's third in another concert, which is also in D minor, and they were doing Dvorak's Seventh Symphony, which is in D minor. And I think they were doing the Don Giovanni Overture, which starts in D minor. I don't know whether this has any impact on the audience, really. I suppose you'd need to have perfect pitch to be bothered by it. But it did seem a rather odd idea, but at the time we did it, it was actually wonderful. But the difference in Philadelphia is that Maestro wanted to have three Bs rather than a B, an M, and a B. And so we ended up with Beethoven in E-flat major.
Not bad.
Yes, which is very close to D minor, right?
Indeed, it is, yeah.
Well, so it's really quite astounding. It's the Bach Piano Concerto in D minor, of course, the Brahms, number one, and the Beethoven Emperor, as we know it, number five. And just tell us a little bit more about your schedule, and have you ever recorded any of these?
I had to think twice then. I believe a live concert from the Proms in London from several decades ago, when I played Beethoven's Fifth, was put out on CD by the BBC. And yes, I have recorded the Brahms D minor with Svetlanov and the Philharmonia Orchestra for EMI, which I believe is known as Angel in the US.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1989. So actually, it's a historical recording, really, let's face it. But yes, I have. Not the Bach, though. The Bach is probably the newest to me of the three pieces. I think I need another 20 years playing it regularly before recording it.
Well, Bach is like that, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's so much to see and to learn, and you learn as you practice, I think.
Yeah, well, in some ways, it's the most difficult piece on the program.
And for our audience, can you explain that?
Well, for me, I should say, it's probably the most difficult piece on the program. First of all, it was, of course, originally written for a harpsichord, and therefore one has to adapt to the music on the modern instrument. That's the first problem. The second one is for me specifically is that I suppose I came into the profession from the 20th century about 30 years ago, and moved backwards in time. So gradually, the music from the Romantic era, then the Classical era, then the Baroque period, they came to me professionally in that order. And that's not to say that I didn't learn them the other way around when I was a child, but that's different. As a professional, I was definitely exposed mostly in music of the 20th century when I first began. So Bach is a long way from that, of course. Relatively recently, I first of all explored Mozart and Haydn in a big way, and then eventually Bach. And here we are.
If I may interject for just a second, that
please.
Is very interesting, Peter, what you're saying, because in my experience, I was a little bit similar being exposed to Bach, because as a young child, they call it Wunderkind, that's what they call me, but I don't necessarily agree. But I mostly loved the Romantic era, not the 20th century. In fact, I detested the 20th century. It, to me, seemed like very odd, very not soothing, not harmonically correct, and so forth. But anyway, so I grew up with the big Romantics on the piano, and then when I switched over when I was 16 to the organ, in Bucharest at the Cathedral of St. Joseph. And then it was only then that I started to I hated Bach. Don Gregorio, my former mentor, piano teacher that has come here many times to Philadelphia before you, insisted that I have to learn Bach, almost that I felt like, you know, when you have a cold and your mother makes you eat chicken soup. Really like that. And said,
well, I think
Don
Gregorio and your mother were probably both right.
Yes.
In both cases.
So anyway, if you can believe such a thing, I remember doing the two-part invention, three-part invention, the Italian suites, the French suites, and then and only then I had to do every single prelude and fugue of the well-tempered clavier, both first and second volume. And because of the fact that I was forced, you know, I just became so anti-Bach, and I loaded it. I couldn't stand. I couldn't see anything other than almost like a computerized mathematical notes on the piano, on the piece of paper. Anyway, but that all changed when I started to play the organ, and I started to play some of the chorales and some of the preludes and fugues and so forth. And I think it was a combination of the fact that, to me, by then I learned that Bach was associated with, St. Thomas Church in Leipzig, and he was an organist and blah, 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 and so forth and so on. And that... And then I started slowly to go back to Bach and to like the keyboard pieces, which I call it, not piano, not harpsichord, keyboard. And so it's very interesting to hear what you're saying, because I relate to that kind of a thing. So it was just an interesting...
Well, it's slightly parallel, because I think all keyboard instrumentalists, if they're taught well, are not forced but persuaded in their very, very early stages to tackle Bach.
Yes.
And
yes.
If you tackle it too much, first of all, it's amongst the most difficult music ever written, and therefore it becomes overfacing.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
And it's a matter of degree. It's getting the balance right, I think.
Yes.
Perhaps my teachers did, because I was never forced to do all the 48 preludes and fugues, but I did decide I would do them only about 7-8 years ago. It took me 5 years to really feel comfortable with doing them publicly.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, I mean, it is the most... I can honestly say it's the most difficult music I've ever played, those 48 preludes and fugues.
Yes.
It's very interesting regarding one's learning curve as well. We all do a prelude and fugue or five when we're young.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of them, we tend not to do. But I think there are exceptions, but most people do that, I think, and I was one of them. And those five that I did, or six, or whatever it was when I was really young, like about 8 or 9, are there for life.
Yes.
And what that says about how important it is to get it right at a certain age is, well, it's beyond words, really.
Well, tell us a little bit about your thoughts on the other two Bs, on the Brahms and on the Emperor.
Well, you know, there are actually direct links between all three,
yes.
apart from the fact that they began with B and they came from Germany. There are many other comparisons. Whether this is because they're German and the way the German culture developed in this way, or whether it was these specific composers, I'm not quite sure. Perhaps a little bit of both. But the logic of all their music is maybe greater than with any other composers. That the sublime feeling of not just intellectual logic, but the fact that that intellectual logic is completely natural, mm-hmm. and therefore that all the emotions that come with the music, to people who understand to a greater or a lesser degree the actual logic, they feel it somehow subliminally.
Yes.
That it is perfect, that it has a fantastic sense of timing,
yes.
in the sense that there's an architecture to it. So you can always feel when the climax is coming, you can always feel when the end of a movement is coming, in a way that perhaps isn't a priority with the music of almost anyone else, and certainly with music that isn't German, because that logic is so fundamental to the, you know, for example, their cathedrals and so on.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what about the key of D minor? Anything to say about that?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because I've been recently playing a lot of music by Scriabin, who had what a condition called synesthesia, which, of course, Messiaen, my teacher, mm-hmm. or briefly
yes.
my teacher,
mm-hmm.
also had. And I'm not quite sure that I know what I'm talking about enough to be sure, but I do believe that there's some kind of connection between synesthesia and seeing colours in music and identifying moods with certain keys. And the D minor of Beethoven is very defiant and very challenging, and it usually becomes D major and therefore very triumphant in the end. With Brahms, to some degree, the same kind of thing. With Bach, it's something else, and I don't know what that something else is. It's not possible to put it into words, but every key has a colour of its own in Bach, and that's what the whole point of, for example, the well-tempered clavier, which has a prelude and fugue in every single
yes.
key.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, two of them in every single key. And those keys have an identity which, it's a little bit like the Chopin ballades. You know that there's something going on and it's got a story, but you don't know what it is.
It's profound, especially the minor key, I think it is.
Yeah, very much so.
Very. So, of course, you have quite a daunting program here, and probably finishing up with The Emperor, which is a jewel. And
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your interpretation of that.
Well, the Beethoven Emperor is very significant to me because it was the first classical work that I ever identified as a piece of music I loved. As a very small child, my father picked up a pile of 78 gramophone records. You know, those
yes.
that were made of wax from decades ago.
Right.
And the gramophone with a wind-up mechanism from a market somewhere brought it home and basically expected me to play with it as a toy. And part of the collection of discs was the Beethoven Emperor Concerto with the first disc missing. So I spent several months trying to work out which order these records went in. It never occurred to me to look at the index numbers. I just did it orally. I came up with the wrong order, of course, and it ended up with the piece, as far as I was concerned, ended with the end of the first movement and began with the beginning of the second movement, and it was all complete hodgepodge. But it became such an important piece to me because it was the one that made me want to be a musician.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, it's a marvelous
wow.
work. I'm just wondering, it is kind
yeah.
of a jewel in the crown, I think, of yeah. all classical music, that number
five. It does seem to be seminal for so mm. many people.
Mm-hmm.
People who, colleagues of mine at all stages, all when I say colleagues, I suppose I mean mainly pianists. But, you know, it with so many people, it's the piece that inspired them the most when they were very young. The fourth concerto inspires me in a different way. It's, you know, it's equally great. But the fifth concerto is the one that grabs us all. It's one of the most popular pieces ever
yes.
written.
Yes, mm-hmm.
You could
and justifiably, I would say. I would say so. It's glorious. Just
oh, it
glorious.
Is. It's
yeah.
absolutely phenomenal. It's impossible to identify exactly why. It's interesting, isn't it, that Franz Liszt, who played all the Beethoven symphonies transcribed for piano himself all over the place, and generally loved Beethoven. I think he edited an edition of all the sonatas. But the one piano concerto that he played publicly was the fifth, and he never did the other four, which is an odd thing, but I can see somehow it seems logical.
Well, I just want to ask you, are we going to have a regular visit from you every year here?
Yes.
Well, one can only go where one is invited.
So far, I've been invited. He already invited you, I think, Valentino.
We have a date already for Gershwin and others on 8th of January, 2016. Yeah. That is to say, if Maestro Donohoe would be gracious enough to visit us.
Well, it would be an enormous pleasure. And to play Gershwin in America and any other American music in America for a non-American is always a little bit of a challenge. It probably is for a Romanian to conduct it as well. But actually, it seems to work really well.
An American in Paris, let's not forget that. Well, Gershwin was in France when he wrote that. So, indeed.
He was born in Odessa in Ukraine.
Yes, yes.
Which is one of those things that I found very surprising when I discovered it. But
he was,
it was
born, or just his folks were born there?
I think.
No, he was born. He was born in Odessa.
Oh, he does.
Yes, I think it's true, yeah. Although where you're actually born, it is less important to where you're actually brought up, I suppose, when it comes to musical culture. But you can hear a lot of Russian and Eastern European influence on Gershwin's music.
Yes.
Particularly when he's being lyrical.
He made Brooklyn famous because he, for most of his time, when he was asked where he's from, he didn't say New York, he said Brooklyn.
People from Brooklyn feel that way, actually.
Like it's an island. Yeah.
It's wonderful to speak with you and to see you once again, and we hope that we can look forward to this. We'll just have to have a regular concert every year, and we'll have our regular interviews on Crossover. And I hope to see you this time, and I'm sure it's going to be smashing. So once again, thank you so much for coming.
We are all so looking forward to seeing you, Peter, the orchestra, and the public, and it's going to be an absolute feast.
I'm looking forward to every moment. Thank you very much, Valentin.
Wonderful.
You're very welcome.
Wonderful
thank you.
To speak
and
once
thank you again, Jill.
Yes, the same here. See you then.
Yeah. Bye.